the next speaker.
Okay. Thank you very much. And thanks to the Field Institute and to Tomas for organizing this. If I have a choice in the matter, I'd rather have the room lights on because I like to see your faces so that I can tell when I've lost people. Some of the I hope you can read the material on the screen, but thank you very much. One of the other things that I like to do as a teacher in my classroom, and forgive me if I treat you like students, but in my book that's a high compliment, one of the things that I often do is pass around hopefully relevant material so that if you're bored with what I'm saying, you can look at something else and be distracted. And so that's what I'm going to do here. What I'm going to pass around are various of the books related to automatic differentiation. If you're not familiar with the field, these five are a good place to start. This is a book by Andreas Grewank, who tried to explain everything there is to know about automatic differentiation. The next three are various proceedings of automatic differentiation meetings. And the book that I use the most is by Lewis Rawl, 1981, and I can understand it. Maybe some of you can too. So please pass those around as I thought. They don't have to stay in sync, and we'll go from there. So I should also observe that speaking in this room is particularly meaningful for me because the last time I was in this room was on 9/11, and we had televisions back here, and I sat here and watched the World Trade Center's collapse, and so I'm happy to be back, and I hope that nothing collapses while I'm speaking this time. I really appreciated the hospitality of our Canadian colleagues in a time that was very difficult. It was interesting for me to sort of see those events unfolding through Canadian eyes, which in many ways are similar and in many ways are different. So, but I'm supposed to talk about automatic differentiation. So that was the abstract that we published. A good place to start is to make sure now, if this is an optimization seminar, I suspect that all of you already understand why you might want derivatives, but let me point out some of them. So if you may have code that requires derivatives, you may be using finite differences, you may want sensitivity or adjoint, so any of these kind of things, if you're involved with, that might be an indication that derivatives are for you. The kind of automatic differentiation that we'll be talking about here is represented in Microsoft Excel. So that's sort of buried down deep inside. You don't have access to it, but the solve function in Excel uses automatic differentiation. So at an automatic differentiation meeting about 4 years ago, you know, people were standing up, and the people from Argonne were standing up and saying, oh, we have 400 users, and the people from INRIA were standing up and saying, oh, we have 300 or 400 users, and the guy from Frontline Systems stood up and says, we've got tens of millions of users. So automatic differentiation is on everybody's desktop, whether they use it or not. It's also behind the scenes in what Ample and Neos use, and one good indication is that of sort of the importance of an automatic tool, as we're going to be talking about, if you sort of browse through the libraries for IMSL or NAG, what you often find of many of the routines that an application person would use, you'll often find two versions of the routines, one that they supply the derivatives by usually finite differences, and a matching routine that if you know the derivatives, you can pass the derivatives in, and conventional wisdom, and it's usually true, that if you give accurate derivatives, you probably will get better results and better performance than from finite differences. In terms of just sort of to illustrate sensitivity, since one of the applications of automatic differentiation, you notice I'm sort of spicing my slides with some pictures that hint at some of the applications that people might use. One of them is the weather. This one we probably do. This one we do need to see the screen. So let's try which one of these work. No, that's the wrong answer. That's the wrong answer. There we go. Okay. I'll turn them back on in a moment. So here's a thunderstorm building. Weather forecasting is one of the applications where sensitivities are important. Here's what that same thunderstorm looked like just 10 minutes later. So if that's how sensitive nature is, for our software to be able to model those kind of things, a good understanding of sensitivities is very important. So if we try to understand what we mean by automatic or computational differentiation, it means that we want to propagate values, and by propagating those values, what we're going to get are going to be accurate up to the round-off error of calculation, as opposed to symbolic or numeric calculations. The symbolic calculations are subject to expression swell. The finite differences are subject to, oh, what value of h should we use, and round-off errors. In the early days of automatic differentiation, we worked really hard to explain how we were different from symbolic differentiation. We don't do that anymore, at least most of us don't. And the reason why we don't is one of the techniques that we'll see is a source code transformation, where basically you give me a source code for your function and I go mung away on it and give you back source code for the derivative. That's symbolic processing. So we got to say that the symbolic people are our friends rather than our opponents. This slide suggests the basic functionality of automatic differentiation, and what it suggests is that, as I just got done describing, is that if you have a program for evaluating some function, that we can apply a tool of automatic differentiation, and we'll talk about several of them and the basic ideas of how they work, and what I'll give you back is a program that computes the derivative. That can be done by source code transformation, and here are several tools that do that. That means we literally start with the source, process it, and give you back the source for the derivative, or we can do it by operator overloading, and here are some examples of tools that work in that way. Basically, automatic differentiation just implements the chain rule. So one of the challenges for the automatic differentiation community is if what we're doing is the same thing that all of your freshman calculus students are supposed to be able to do, why should we get funding for that? And part of Andreas's mission is to try to demonstrate the deep and subtle theory that's here, partly to make us sound important to funding agencies, and one of the consequences of that is sometimes if we're not careful, we lose track of the real simplicity that's here. And that's partly what I hope that you get if you haven't already seen automatic Oh, how many of you would sort of admit to at least a passing familiarity with automatic differentiation? Okay, so I have some idea of how much of the choir I'm preaching to. All right, good. So roughly speaking, if we have some sort of a function of many variables, its gradient vector is going to look like that, and that's something that we'd require, for example, by optimization. If we're going to augment our code to compute those, that it's fairly simple that if our original code has sums or products or differences, that the code that we produce either by transformation or by operator overloading is basically doing what you hope that your freshman calculus students can do. If you have elementary functions, well, then you have to use the chain rule, and our software ought to be able to do that too. So for any differentiable function for which we have known derivatives, automatic differentiation can work. So if we make things a little bit more interesting, instead of single operations, so here we have a function of, in this case, two variables. One way of looking at that is if we parse that expression into a sequence of unary and binary operations, and this sort of represents the code list that we'd think that a compiler would generate or something like that, we can annotate this program in either what's called a forward or a reverse mode of calculating derivatives. And what I want to do is give you a little bit of an indication about what the meaning of each of those are. The pictures here, by the way, you may see more about these pictures in the next talk, or not? Is that not what?
Some of it,
okay. They're simply here as sort of eye candy to help remind you of some of the applications. In this case, the idea of calculating sensitivities of fluid flow around an aircraft wing, although that's not what I'm going to talk about. If we, looks like it's time for the lights again. Good. So the idea here is okay, so we'll go dark for a while. That's still, okay. What's missing here is the computational graph, and what we have, this is simply a graph that has nodes for each of the operations in that expression. For a simple expression like this, that doesn't add very much, but for complicated programs, we'll need to be able to understand what the flow of control is going to be in order to automate the transformation process. In the forward mode, is basically what your first semester calculus students would do, and if they're good students. And the idea, so here is the code list of the operations from that earlier expression, and what this suggests is we're going to augment the program that calculates the function by statements that look like these, and I think if we go through each one of them, I hope I've given this talk enough that I got the slides right. So for example, here we add two things together, so here we add the gradients and so on, and then over here we're sort of keeping track symbolically of what we would get by doing these calculations, and so if you're sufficiently bored, you can check and see whether I got the right answer. The point of this is that we calculate the derivatives, that the function involves scalar operations. Calculating the derivative objects involving the gradients are vector operations. So in the right context, we might consider parallelizing or vectorizing the derivative objects. Yes? Yes. I missed the word you used. Yes. Correct. Well, I have to know when I encounter the sine function, how am I supposed to compute its derivative? So I have to know that the derivative of the sine is the cosine, and vice versa. And so what that one of the things that means, if you're worried about the efficiency of this, which we'll talk a little bit about as we go, that however expensive it is to evaluate the function, you're going to have a similar expense over here in evaluating the cosine. This one doesn't happen to involve exponentials or inverse hyperbolic cotangents, but for any elementary function that is in our library, we either know or we need to figure out what its derivative is and build that knowledge into our system. And that's the knowledge that we hope is replicating what our freshman calculus students can do. That's the forward mode. The trouble with the forward mode hopefully is simple and easy to understand. The difficulty with the forward mode is that, let's see, many of you folks are doing optimization. How many independent variables do you often use in your objective function? Hundreds of thousands? Higher than that? Nobody here is using tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, or millions? Okay, people do. And so what you'd see then is that, roughly speaking, the cost of calculating the derivative is going to be of the order of the number of independent variables times the cost of evaluating the function. So if the cost of evaluating the function is a couple hours, and you are looking at thousands or hundreds of thousands of independent variables, the forward mode is absolutely infeasible for problems that you'd be interested in. You need to do better. So the other way of looking at these things is called the reverse mode. And the idea here is that while the forward mode calculates, if you have a sequence of operations, as you go down at each step, you're calculating the derivative of that independent variable with intermediate variable with respect to the independent variable that you started with. So everything is you're calculating derivatives with respect to x, so to speak. The reverse mode says, let's look at it the other way. Let's think of starting at the bottom of that execution sequence, and for each of the intermediate variables, let's calculate the partial derivative of the output variable, with respect to that intermediate variable. So we're calculating the partial derivative of the dependence with respect to the intermediates. So those are called adjoint variables, and they've been independently discovered in many application areas. It's basically, if you have a large code and you want to compute sensitivities, the reverse mode or adjoint variables are the only feasible way to do it. So the key role for evaluating the reverse mode is that if you have an intermediate variable, so I've already done the parsing into unary and binary operations by the time I get to this expression here. So my f is adding two variables or multiplying two variables or taking the sign or something like that. So these are, each one of these are simple functions. That what I need to do to propagate them, now I'm propagating them backwards because I'm computing the partial derivative of the answer with respect to each of the intermediates. Now the reason that works is by the time I get up to the top, where the intermediates are the independent variables, then the derivative of dependent with respect to intermediate, if intermediate is the beginning independent, great, I got what I wanted. So all that these are incrementing adjoint variables. The difficulty of the reverse mode is it requires the ability to sort of start at the bottom and go backwards. Now, if your code is as simple as the example we're looking at here, you can write that down, but as soon as your code is large or has loops and branches, that becomes far more challenging. For our simple example, so here's the simple assignment statement, and now what I'm going to do is sort of take that execution trace that we saw a couple slides ago and write them down backwards. So I start with the partial derivative of the answer with respect to itself, which even I can get is 1. And then each one of these in sequence, you just look at, apply the rule that I showed you on the last slide to figure out what the adjoint is, and work your way backwards. Again, each of these rules follow immediately from the rules of calculus, so it's not difficult to build these kind of rules into our either source code transformation or operator overloaded system. By the time we're done and we get to all the way to the end, here we've got the partial derivative of the answer with respect to x in this case, and if you write down what they are and simplify them, unless I made a mistake, I think that you got the same answer as you got in the forward mode, and further I think that they're both correct. So the result at the end of the day is we have our gradient that we've computed here. The advantage here is that where the forward mode propagated vectors, now we're propagating scalars, and it's possible to show that in general the complexity of calculating a gradient in the reverse mode is in the vicinity of 5 times the cost of function evaluation, no matter how many independent variables you've got. So that means if you're doing optimization on hundreds of thousands of independent variables, a gradient costs you about 5 times the cost of the function. Okay? That's why it's worth wrapping your mind around the reverse mode, because the efficiency of it in the kinds of applications that show up doing optimization is well worth the effort. So here's just a little diagram that I took from a paper by Laurent Hascoulet. He's using a different example here, but what to get from this is here are a sequence of operations, and what he's doing is he's showing how each operation is sort of mapped to the reverse mode that's going on here. So this is the part that you execute forward. This is the part that you execute in reverse. And he's just emphasizing sort of the data connections between them. In his paper, he's trying to do a lot more with that picture. But my point here is just to emphasize the difference between executing the program in the forward mode and the adjoints or reverse mode has to go the other way, and you've got data connections between them. So, as often in life, if we have two extreme possibilities, in this case, the forward mode and the reverse mode, and each of them is good in certain circumstances and bad in other circumstances, the right answer probably lies someplace in between them in most applications. So, the next few slides are going to look at several variants of what we might mean by somewhere in between pure forward and pure reverse. So one idea is a pre-accumulation of local derivatives. So now this F can be a fairly complicated thing. It can be a long expression. It can be a chunk of code. It can be a subroutine call. But the idea is that if that's relatively well behaved, you may be able to compute the partial derivatives of this F with respect to its Y and Z, and then you sort of assemble a global gradient object using a chain rule in this kind of way. So you're computing some sort of local partial derivatives and some global partial derivatives and putting them together using the chain rule. ADIFOR, which was developed at Rice and Argonne in the early 90s, uses this kind of approach at the statement level. They're working on extending it to doing it deeper, but that's where it goes right now. It can also be generalized to second derivatives. So, to give you a hint about how the source code implementation works, this is the ADIFOR tool that works in Fortran. So, here's an example of a very, very simple-minded. Now, one of the challenges, of course, in exposition is that if I give you something simple enough that it fits on a finite number of slides, it's a toy problem and nobody's impressed. If I give you a problem that's big enough to be impressive, you can't wrap your mind around it. So I'm going the simple way and assuming that you're bright enough to generalize it. All right. So the impressive thing here is not that I can compute the derivative of the square root. It's I'm trying to illustrate how the tool works. So we start out with a simple source code that might look something like this. It's a function call. It computes some stuff. And what it computes in the body here is not particularly relevant for this example. So this is the source code that I start with. I'm going to pass it to the ADIFOR tool, and the ADIFOR tool is going to give me back Fortran that computes the derivative. So here it is. And as much machine-generated code, it's kind of ugly. But what's sort of happening here is that you're passing in. Here was the x that was passed in. You're passing a gradient object of x coming in. You were supposed to pass back a y, and you're passing back the gradient object of y. Here you sort of do some error checking. Then this is the statement that was in the function in the first place, so we're calculating the value. And now we got to check and make sure that if we're going to take the derivative, that x is greater than 0. And otherwise, you got to do some error handling. And then this is where the derivative is actually computed. And what you see is we're just going through a loop that's multiplying the value that we have computed here times the gradient of the x that was passed in. And so we've generated code that starts with the function and returns to you code for the derivative. This is forward. ADIFOR is currently a forward mode tool. The next thing that you need to do is, okay, we have a function that computes the derivative. You've got to call it. Now, in many of your applications, if that function had represented, say, an objective function or a constraint, you would need to wrap that up in whatever form your particular optimization package wanted to calculate the derivative of the function. And so this is sort of a generic idea of what the driver might look like. So I'm setting things up, and here's where I call my derivative square root that's going to give me, I pass in the value of x and its gradient, I get back the value of y and its gradient, and then I can use the derivative values from g of y however I want. In this case, I'm simply printing them out. You probably would want to write a wrapper so that to sort of work between your optimization routine and the derivative routine that was generated here. The reason why this picture is vaguely relevant is in one of the proceedings volumes that's going around, there was were two papers about people who used automatic differentiation to calculate the modeling of the machines that grind the gears. And it never occurred to me how complicated it was to figure out what even the surface of the gears should be, let alone how you build the tools to manufacture them. That's how much I'm going to say about this application at the moment. The other strategy for implementing automatic differentiation is operator overloading. So any of you who have even a passing familiarity with programming language like C++, I hope that as I was going along and saying, oh, the add becomes, you add the gradients and things, I hope you're sort of, oh yeah, I see how I could do that by operator overloading. The reverse mode is a little bit more difficult, because in the reverse mode, what you have to do is when you execute the overloaded operator of plus, you sort of have to record in what Grewank refers to as a tape. That may be in memory, it may be on the disk, it may be really on tape, but you need to record, I have executed add, here are the operands that I used. You might as well record the result that you used while you're along with it, and so the overloaded operator is going to record the trace of the instructions that you went through in an overloaded sense. So ADOL-C works on C or C++, it works in forward or reverse mode. It can compute partial derivatives or Taylor series. It can deal with Jacobians with various structures. Andreas has done some work with various kinds of ordinary differential equation solving. But one of the features of ADOL-C that he and his co-workers are most proud of is the checkpointing. And the idea of checkpointing is, let's see, if we're going to do the reverse mode, you recall that as we've gone through our whole execution trace, and maybe for a large optimization problem, that could easily be an hour or two of CPU time just to evaluate your objective function, we've now got to be able to take that same sequence of operations and do them backwards. And so somehow, when you're going backwards, you have to know what it was that you did going forward, so you've got to record all of those. Well, that's a lot of information, yes? Okay, if you think about the speed of our current processors and you're going to record all of the operations that they do in order that you can execute those backwards, that's a lot of space. It may be more space than you have available in memory. It may be more space than you have available on your disk farm. So one of the ideas of checkpointing is that what you're going to do is you're going to execute the code in its normal forward direction and record your operations, and then you're going to take a snapshot of memory. And then you're going to resume the calculations, and the idea is now you reverse, and when you get back to where the checkpoint was, you can restart your calculations at the point of that checkpoint. So checkpointing is a feature of avoiding recording as many operations. It's intended to make it feasible to do the reverse mode on truly large problems. The next part, jump discontinuity. The next thing that I want to turn our attention to is to say, okay, I've seen a few heads sort of nodding up and down as though you believe me that maybe we can do the automatic differentiation as I've described. How many of you consider yourself in some sense mathematicians? In some sense, I'm not going to make fun of you, I am too. One of the lack of stability in the example that Tomas gave, I've been at Marquette for a very long time, but a little over 3 years ago I moved from the math department to electrical and computer engineering, so that there's some instability there. Anyway, I still consider myself a mathematician. And for the mathematicians among us, I hope that you say, hey, wait a minute. If you say you can take any computer code and calculate its derivatives, hold on just a minute, because a lot of functions are not differentiable, and I'll bet that a lot of computer code isn't differentiable either, and if you're going to do this automatically, there's something that doesn't compute here. And so what I want to do is look at a few of the mathematical pitfalls that occur. So one of them is, suppose that the function that I'm trying to differentiate is not differentiable. So our function is defined, but the derivative doesn't exist. Of course, absolute value is the generic example. Now, please understand, I'm not trying to tell you how to take the derivative of the absolute value. Knowledge of differentiating ABS is built into our process. I simply want to illustrate the kind of thing that our code has to do. So suppose that we might have code that says if x is less than 0, then f is minus x. And, well, the derivative of that is f prime is minus x prime. Otherwise, so if x is greater than or equal to 0, then f is x, and the derivative is this. Those are the transformations that you would make to these two pieces. And the result is that when we execute our code, we get that the derivative of the absolute value at 0 is 1 times, and we've shown that it's differentiable. Okay? Not okay, but yes, that's what the code does. So the issue here is about handling, and the warning is you ought to know what you're doing, that it's only automatic up to a certain sense, that if I am asked to automatically differentiate code like this, I'm trying to read the programmer's mind, and the error message for that program says none found. Here's another example. Suppose that you have a function that in this case is just calculating f equals x squared, but for some reason you happen to know that when x is equal to 1, f is equal to 1, so you hard code that. Now the derivative of 1 is equal to 0, and the derivative of x squared is this. And so now what we have said is that the derivative of x squared at 1 is 0. That's a problem, yeah? Now, this example has a story behind it, and that is Andreas and I were refereeing, and I've told the story to the author of the paper, so I'm not disclosing any confidences. Andreas and I had been asked to referee a paper by Herb Fisher that had this and a bunch of other examples in it, and we were about ready to reject the paper and saying, come on, I mean, this is silly. You know, it's, yes, that's accurate, but publish a paper about it, I don't think so. And we'd drawn up the rejecting referees report, but hadn't sent it out yet, and we were struggling at the same time with a code that I think it was code we had gotten from General Motors, and ADAFOR was not getting the right answer. And we couldn't figure out for the life of us why ADAFOR wasn't getting the right answer. And, well, it turned out that there was one special value. It didn't happen to be x equal 1. It happened to be x equals 0, where they happened to know what the answer was. And so they just hard-coded the answer was 7 or whatever it was. And we returned the value of 0 as the derivative of 7, and it was wrong. And so we had to sort of admit that maybe realistic code does do that. After all, if you know what the answer is, why would you go away and compute it forever? Just give the answer back.
Does it actually have inequality?
In that case, it did, but in that case, the reason why was because it was the initial condition. They were starting something out at a value that they knew. What we'd say is automatic differentiation differentiates your code and not your intentions. Here's another example, and this figure sort of looks like my graphics got out of control, and that's exactly what I want it to look like. The idea here is that in many applications you want to define a function implicitly. And so generically, you have some function like this that implicitly defines a function. If it defines a function, it's also going to define a derivative. And basically the way that you would solve this is you'd probably do some preconditioning, you'd iterate, maybe with a Newton-like iteration, maybe with something else, you have a convergence test, so Newton's method would be an example of that, and now we want to differentiate that. Well, this differentiation is supposed to be automatic. So one thing we can do is called a black box. We can just apply automatic differentiation. You have code here that works. I assert that I can compute the derivative of the code that you do, so I turn on automatic differentiation. Usually it works. We may need one or two extra iterations, because if you think about it, you're hoping that the iteration for the derivative is also converging, and it might not converge quite as fast as the iteration for the underlying function. So there's some reason to believe that one or two extra iterations might be a good idea, but under certain circumstances that can fail. A second strategy is to say, well, I know what's going on here, so we can iterate our function to convergence and have our test based on the value of f. Then we turn on automatic differentiation for one iteration. After all, if you think about how you're calculating it, calculating z as a function of x is, that's just defining a function, and all of the earlier iterations were just getting there. The last iteration is the one that computes the function value, so that's the only one you really need to differentiate. So turn on your differentiation process there, and devise tests based on what you know the derivative is according to the chain rule. And again, you usually find that one iteration suffices. So here was an example that people at Argonne worked on. So the example came from NASA. We looked at a variety of wing shape parameters, had to generate the 3D finite element grid, iterate through that. But by using the sort of trick that I'm talking about up here, by turning on and off the automatic differentiation, the derivative ended up costing us only a few percent more than finding the value of the function in the first place. Strategy three says use some math, that after all, we know what the formula for the derivative is according to the implicit function theorem, write it down. And now we have two partial derivatives of capital F that we need. We can use automatic differentiation to compute not the derivative of Z, but the partial derivative of F with respect to these two pieces, and we can assemble those ourselves. That doesn't sound too automatic anymore, does it? But what we find is a little bit of math beats a lot of computing. There have been quite a few people who have done work in that area. In terms of various compiler technologies, the source transformation, if you think about what you want to do to start with a function for f and generate a function for the derivative, a lot of what we need to do is the same sort of thing that the compiler needs to do, especially a good optimizing compiler. One of the things that we have to do, for example, is figure out on the sort of computational path from the independent variables to the dependent variables, which of the intermediates do you calculate that depend on independent variables that you want to differentiate with respect to, as opposed to other parameters of the problem that you're holding fixed, and which of them may affect other output variables besides the one you're trying to differentiate. So you need to do some activity analysis, but that's exactly what a optimizing parallel compiler often does. So these are some of the tools from the compiler writing field that it takes to make these AD tools work. Both Sun and NAG have said publicly that they've said that Fortran compilers will soon have a minus AD option. I hope that's true. Actually, the hard part of that is figuring out what the user interface should be, because if you have the ability to say, compile this file and also give me the derivative, of sort of figuring out how do you specify what are independent and dependent variables and what should the parameter sequence be and stuff like that is another part of the issue. This slide illustrates the idea of checkpointing that I talked a little bit about before. The trouble here, recall, was that the reverse mode takes a lot of memory space. And so to do that, The kind of thing that you might do is this illustrates executing the code without recording the operations. The theory is you don't have enough storage space to record them all. You get to this point and you take a snapshot of memory. So you checkpoint. We also are interested in checkpointing in sort of parallel processing so that in case something goes wrong, we can restart the calculation. So again, we're taking advantage of existing compiler technology to make our AD stuff work. Then in this picture, once you've dropped the checkpoint, you now turn on the recording of the trace. You execute that to the end, and now that much you can execute in a reverse mode. Ideally, what's happened here is you've timed it just right, so this recording of the tape uses all of your available information. Then you can play that backwards. But once you get back to here, you don't have, you have not recorded this part. So in this case, with only one, what you need to do is go back to the, and this would be the checkpoint that you left at the beginning, and record forward again, and then you can reverse that part. So in this case, the checkpoint would be not here, as I said, but at the beginning. And what you're trying to do is sort of finesse the very large amount of memory that you need. Now, of course, to be practical, you need to do that with multiple checkpoints. This is the discussion of the complexity that I alluded to earlier, and basically the takeaway from this slide is that the forward mode has a cost proportional to the execution of the function. The reverse mode has a cost proportional to usually approximately 5 times the cost of F. And so this gives you sort of some rules of thumb about when you should prefer the forward and reverse mode. In many optimization algorithms, if what you really want is the gradient, what you really want is the reverse mode. This slide is showing from a practical example for several different tools, and so this slide also serves as a list of some of the automatic differentiation tools that are available. This column shows how long it took to calculate the gradient. This is a ratio of the gradient to the time to evaluate the function. This is a measure of how accurate the results were compared to the results that Adafor gave. So one of the things that I got upset listening to talks at Argonne is I don't know how many people I heard give talks about parallel processing and, oh, we got this wonderful speed up. And when I asked, did you get the right answer, there was one case where I had to ask the question about 3 or 4 times before the speaker even understood the question of did you get the right answer. So I felt obligated here to say this is how close I came to getting the right answer in computing these derivatives. Earlier I suggested that if there are two extremes, forward mode and reverse mode, the truth of life might lie someplace in between them. You can formulate either the forward mode or the reverse mode as a graph node elimination problem. And basically the forward mode eliminates them in one order and the reverse mode eliminates them in the other order. Well, who says that you need to eliminate them either monotonically? I wonder if we could come up with an algorithm that would sort of do an optimal node elimination strategy. So here's an example of an expression. And the idea here is that if you evaluate from either end, that's not the right answer. What you probably want to do is eliminate the node in the middle. That'll collapse into these two. Then you can eliminate that. And the point is that by viewing this forward versus reverse as a graph node elimination problem, there are a lot of people who have done a lot of work in that area. We may be able to perform much, much better. So that's one example of a graph that looks like that. Here are a couple more. This is from a paper by Uwe Naumann, and these examples were cooked up by him to try to illustrate that different elimination strategies that had been proposed were not optimal, and of course the optimal strategy for node elimination is very difficult. This picture sort of illustrates the result of 4 different node elimination strategies. I show you this slide that the details are not particularly important given the scope of this talk. What I do want you to take away from this slide are that there are different ways that you can eliminate the nodes from the graph. And what we're showing here are here we're looking at the order in which things are eliminated versus the number of steps. So these pictures are sort of representing the order in which you eliminate the nodes from a fairly complicated graph. And the point here is, do those four pictures look the same? No. So different strategies really do give you different orders for eliminating the nodes from a graph. And research is ongoing about an optimal order for doing that. Applications. How many of you can even read what any of those say? Ones in front, I hope, can. Yeah. The point of that is that these are applications that of the three proceedings books that I'm passing around, all of these applications are represented in one or more of those articles. So it seems to me that as scientific computing tool builders, every once in a while somebody is guilty of just sort of going off in a corner someplace and writing a tool and, oh, it's absolutely a wonderful tool, except it's not the right tool for any problem that anybody has. The reason for giving a list like this is to demonstrate lots and lots of people with real practical problems, from aircraft design to grinding gear teeth, have found the automatic differentiation tools that we're talking about here useful. So I hope what you take away from this are that the automatic differentiation tools that I'm talking about give us a way of computing derivatives efficiently, accurately, and, well, easily, I suppose we could argue with. That sort of depends on how advanced you want to get in your work. But the idea here now is that if we represent tool builders, so if you're building optimization tools, if you have always said, oh, gee, I'd like to use a derivative, but if I want to use a third order derivative, God, nobody's ever going to be able to give me a third order derivative. How can I ever do that? The rules of the game have changed. So if you have some wonderful ideas for using third or fourth or fifth order derivatives in your optimization algorithm, probably for low dimensions for fourth and fifth order derivatives, but you don't have to be scared that nobody will be able to give me those derivatives any longer. People can give, or you can build the machinery to give yourself those derivatives. So we open up a whole new range of algorithms that we could never consider before. Black box users of the technology, it works reliably on most applications that people try. For the most part, taking the code and plugging it into the tool, most of the applications work. They usually get the right answer. They usually get the right answer in a time that's roughly equivalent to finite differences. Sometimes we win, sometimes we lose, but you're not paying a speed penalty. If you really know what you're doing and you're willing to apply knowledge of the problem, as several of the examples I've shown illustrate, you have the possibility of getting the right answers and getting them very, very fast. Are there any questions? Yes.
Generate the output program, which is the
custodian. Yes.
Okay, so you talked about reverse both being preferable in certain circumstances.
Yes.
Because of the complexity of the output algorithm.
Yes.
My question is about the complexity of the forward versus reverse mode for computing the output algorithm. Right. Just if I take a program and I run it through and generate an output with forward mode, or generate with versus reverse mode, just sort of a How long would they take comparatively, as opposed to a lot of standard functions? Is my question clear?
Yes, your question is clear. My answer will not be. Well, maybe it will. The current state of the art is that the source transformation tools are just barely able to do the transformation for the reverse mode in not too bad problems. that the tools which really are successful doing reverse mode now are doing it by operator overloading that records the runtime execution trace.